Since we broadcast to the part of Oregon mostly south of Eugene, we're talking to a very un-Portland part of the state. Smaller cities, drier climates, and some other features that people from elsewhere might not normally associate with Oregon. But even people in this Oregon don't often know a great deal about the vast expanse of the state east of the Cascade Mountains. That's the part of the state Thomas R. Cox writes about in his book, The Other Oregon: People, Environment, and History East of the Cascades. Thomas Cox is a historian who grew up in eastern Oregon and later spent much of his academic career at San Diego State University. He was a founding member of the American Society of Environmental History. His book comes out on Oregon State University Press. Thomas Cox, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning.
Good to have you. Let's start with your dedication to all who love this, in your words, hard, haunting, somehow beautiful land. Hard, I get, but what's the haunting part?
You can't get away from it. I've spent 30 years in San Diego, and I always missed it. It grabs you.
Once you're there, and it gets to be a bit of you, it never leaves you, right?
That's it.
You know how to start your book with a great story. Talk about your daughter arriving for her freshman year at Linfield College and the conversation she had about where she was from.
Well, maybe I should just read a little bit of it.
Okay.
Some years ago, my younger daughter arrived on the Linfield College campus in McMinnville, Oregon, to begin her undergraduate career. Upon learning she was from San Diego, her dormitory roommate, a dyed-in-the-wool Oregonian, launched into an attack on California and all things Californian. "But I was born in Oregon," my daughter protested. "Where?" the roommate demanded. "Redmond." "Oh, that doesn't count." You know, although Redmond's in Oregon, it's east of the Cascades. It's actually west of the center of the state, but east of the Cascades, and that didn't count.
Well, you know, but it's interesting, though, because as you begin to walk us into eastern Oregon, you take us by the hand and take us across the mountains, you point out that you know, people may think of, you know, Bend, Redmond, Prineville, all as one thing, but you point out even within those communities, not very far apart, there are some distinct differences.
Yes, it's a central point that I have to make. People that first settle a community set a tone, and they don't all come from the same place. You know, Prineville was a ranch community, and then later lumbering, but a pretty tough community. They hung some folks from the local bridge by vigilante law and that sort of thing. Bend, by contrast, was only 20 miles away, but it had a very upper class kind of leadership that came in with the big sawmills, and had magnificent homes along Mirror Pond and so on. And they set a tone that was about as different from Prineville as you can get. And Redmond was a quiet agricultural community, different from both of them. So the people that come help to shape communities. It's not just the environment. The environment helps, sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, but so that, you know, just with the details you're providing on those three communities, I mean, that's you probably could have made a book out of that, or at least a small one. But so you set yourself quite a task here, didn't you?
Yes, to my wife's chagrin. She threatens me with my life if I write another book.
Oh, had it with this one, huh?
But it's what I'm trying to do, because it's so varied east of the Cascades. At first glance, you don't see any themes, and I try to dig into it enough that the commonalities come to the surface.
All right, so the people who are thinking, well, that's all over there, you're making sure that you give some details to the over there, then.
Exactly. It's over there, and yet it's in some ways everywhere. You know, people are people. I don't care which side of the mountains they're on. But beyond that, near the end of the book, I have a long chapter on the occupation of the Malheur Wildlife Refuge and the issues that were involved there. And those issues are issues that apply throughout the American West, not just in Oregon east of the Cascades, but Nevada, Idaho, where I live now. As a matter of fact, one of my high school and college friends came over to visit after I first moved here to this little town of 800, and he said, "Well, why'd you move to Idaho?" And I said, "Well, it's like Central Oregon used to be before all the Californians came in and ruined it." And he looked around and he said, "Oh, yeah, you built the house you grew up in. It sits above a rim rock with juniper tree out front and mountains off behind it in the distance." Yeah, okay, I hadn't thought of it, but he was right. This is, in a lot of ways, home.
Very much like home was, as you understood it, growing up in Central Oregon.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then a good part of the book is what has happened to Central Oregon.
All right, we'll get into what happened to Central Oregon and about the places that that got settled and then resettled later on by people from back east. The book is called The Other Oregon, People, Environment, and History East of the Cascades. It's the work of Thomas R. Cox, a historian who spent many years at San Diego State University. He grew up in eastern Oregon, though, and as you heard, is now living in McCammon, Idaho, with a surrounding very much like what he got to know in his days of youth in Central Oregon. We'll come back and talk more with him. If you have some experiences from Eastern Oregon to share with us as well, we would welcome your conversation by phone and email, 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. We'll resume with Thomas R. Cox and The Other Oregon on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on JPR's News and Information Service, Thomas R. Cox is our guest. He is a person who grew up in eastern Oregon and got to know the land well, went away for many years for his career at San Diego State University, came back to settle in Idaho, and to write a book called The Other Oregon, People, Environment, and History East of the Cascades, which lets us know from the get-go that it is more than just everything over there. It's a lot of detail and a lot of nuance that makes Eastern Oregon have a whole bunch of different ecosystems and unique features. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 on the phone. Email address jx@jeffnet.org. I love the description of Eastern Oregon as a place with the bare bones of the earth sticking out. This is a place where the geology is kind of obvious, but not. I mean, some things you told me in the book that I had never even heard of before. Give us the way back story of what Eastern Oregon was like eons ago.
Well, I'm not a geologist, but Thomas Condon, who was one of the pioneer geologists in Oregon, described it as land bounded by mountains to the west and a large inland sea extending to the Rockies with two islands sticking up. The Blue Mountains, which actually it turns out weren't an island but a peninsula off the Rockies, and expanding his view a little further, the Siskiyous. The mountains rise higher and it gets drier and drier until this very different kind of place with inland Pleistocene lakes that were just huge. Great Salt Lake is the major remaining remnant of those, but there were several of them, Modoc, Lahontan, Chivacan, in eastern Oregon and surrounding areas. And it was in this that the first native settlers arrived. The Luther Cressman, leading anthropologist at the University of Oregon, found sandals at Fort Rock Cave that were close to 10,000 years old, and remnants of big megafauna have been found nearby. So, yes, it was dry like it becomes, but what a different world.
Truly, and but you know, there are tales that you point out in the book among the northern Paiute of water once covering the land, so they were there long enough to see that period.
Yes. There is no, unfortunately, history of the northern Paiute, but it's a tale that someone needs to piece together. For the moment, what we have are folk tales that have been gathered by Gerald Ramsey and William Wewa and others, and those by themselves are fascinating.
Talk about, if you would, Tom, how horses got into the region and how they changed the lives of the native people.
There probably was no one thing that came to the area that changed native lives more. They've Pleistocene horses had long since died out, but the Spanish brought horses to the New World, and then in Spanish parts of the northern Spanish parts of the New World, horses were either stolen by natives or they got away. So, and the Comanche were the primary instruments in then spreading the horse north along the western side of the Rockies, primarily, well before all the well-known horse tribes east of the Rockies. The Sioux and so on got horses. They were being spread up the western side of the Rockies by the Shoshone and their relatives. The Shoshone, the Bannock, the Paiute are all members of the Numic language group, so they could communicate and they had cultural similarities. So they arrive in the Northwest somewhere around 1825, and it's interesting that the three tribes that I've studied the most, all of them have tales about when they first saw a horse. The Umatilla report, this guy comes back and tells his tribesmen that he saw these he calls them snakes, they were probably Shoshone, riding elk or deer. And he was fascinated. And later he went back and found out they weren't elk or deer, they were horses. And the Coeur d'Alene up further north of here in Idaho talk about when they first saw a horse. They were at a spring gathering of the Camas where they have a big potlatch and everything. And somebody showed up with a horse. And they all took turns trying to ride it. And they all fell off except for one. And if one had the ability to go back to the original informants, I would be willing to bet that tribal traditions could even tell you who that one person was.
Well, because it is that significant in the tribal history.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And with the Umatilla, they tell that it's Wewa Wewa that goes off and gets the first two horses. And he brings them back, and they describe the horses. One was a paint, and one was a buff cayuse color. And his younger brother, by contrast, was named Ochio, or what we would now say Ochico, which translates as he who has no horse.
Oh, interesting. So yeah, the status definitely coming from the horses, too.
Yes, exactly.
Tom Cox, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, his book is The Other Oregon. So as white explorers describe the region, very much a challenging existence, and as white settlers ended up coming through on the way to the Willamette Valley, few found this an appealing place to stay, Eastern Oregon. But who did stay? Who did decide to settle and remain in Eastern Oregon?
The gold miners, of course, are the big population influx after the John Day gold mining, gold strikes, and so on. But there were some others that went on through to the Willamette Valley and found that the best land was already taken up, or it wasn't all that they'd expected. And then they remembered, rich grasslands around what's now Prineville, or bunch grass on the steppes around Burns and so on, and turned and came back. And it's interesting that how telescoped the history of the area is. 150 years goes back to the earliest settlements in the area, so the history is always pretty close. When I was growing up in Redmond, Jesse Tetherow was still around. He was the grandson of Saul Tetherow, who led that poor, misbegotten Meeks wagon train across through Burns and the desert country, and finally, after half of them starved, made it to the Dalles. The grandson was still alive.
In your lifetime.
That puts the history like yesterday instead of some distant thing that has no connection.
Truly. There was, the Army officer, Major General John Wool, gave an order banning white settlement east of the Cascades in 1856. What was that about?
He said, if there's ever any place in the world that ought to be Indian country, this is it.
Oh, really?
And he was, it's easier to ban white settlement than to put down yet another Indian war.
Interesting. So the clashes were many, as you point out. What was the Snake War of 1864 to 1868?
Well, snake is a pejorative term. The whites attached primarily to the Paiute, but sometimes they'd use it for the Shoshone or the Bannock. But it was a war that was fought in the Burns area primarily, but actually ranged all over that vast interior area. There were battles fought, Battle Mountain in Nevada, over by Susanville in California. The Indians with their horses were so mobile that the Army had to try to find them wherever they were. And General Crook, George Crook, adopted the policy, since they were divided into bands and weren't always, together. You couldn't have the big frontal traditional military confrontation, but he'd pursue them wherever they went, winter and summer, so they didn't have time to hunt and gather and so on, and would eventually get to the point where they'd throw up their hands in despair and say, we can't do this anymore. Hmm. When finally Wiawiwa and the other Paiute chiefs meet with General Crook near Burns, or what would become Burns, Wiawiwa told Crook, we throw away our ropes. And, to most people today, what? But what he meant was, we're going to throw away our ropes. We're not going to steal your horses anymore, which we lead away on ropes. And Crook said, oh, that's too bad. I'm sorry to hear that. I was hoping that you'd keep fighting. That way I could wipe you all out. Because look at my soldiers here. If you kill them, I can pull in more. I always have more. You have to wait till the next generation before you'll have more soldiers. And it was a pretty blunt kind of negotiating tactic, but it was very true. Mm. The Paiute War ends with just the utter exhaustion of the various Paiute bands.
Right, because of the relentlessness of the U.S. Army and the much greater resources. Thomas R. Cox is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a historian who grew up in eastern Oregon, taught many years at San Diego State, now lives in Idaho in an area very much like the eastern Oregon he remembers. His book is The Other Oregon, People, Environment, and History, East of the Cascades. It's a conversation you are able to join here on the Exchange. We welcome your comments and questions at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx at jeffnet.org. You mentioned people who noticed bits of bunch grass here and there on their way through and thought, maybe we could try ranching here. When was the first attempt at cattle ranching in eastern Oregon?
The first big wave that comes in the 1870s, after the early 1870s, after the end of the Snake War. Because by that point it was safe. You know, there are a few stations here and there that were used as stage stops or refueling, resupplying stops for the wagon roads to the military posts. But the first significance in the early 70s, after the end of the war, and Bill Hanley, who's one of the early rancher settlers of the Burns area, recalls when he rode over with a small band of cattle from Josephine County, and his father had told him, "Go until you find a big country, because you'll never be any bigger than the country that you're in." And he recalls how on his way over, he kept watching every rim rock and every hillside for Indians, because he was sure he was going to be attacked. But he wasn't, because the war was over.
So the ZX Ranch is mentioned quite a few times. How big a deal was that in the cattle business in eastern Oregon?
It's huge. The influence extends from Klamath County clear across Lake County. And the acreage varies from time to time. But it's a remnant of the Cattle King domains that were started by John Devine and Miller and Lux and others, and then by Hanley a little bit later in the Burns area. So it's a reminder of what was. The GI Ranch up on the upper Crooked River near Post and Palina is another one. It's a remnant. And yet, both of them have had to evolve and change. You don't ranch the way you used to. There's just not all that acreage of free grass. Now you have to raise winter feed. You have to rotate the cattle onto different pieces of land so you don't overgraze them. And so the ranching practices are totally different.
Well,
free range is gone.
How much did the practices of the cattle people and the sheep people as well change the landscape itself? I mean, you talked about the bunch grass, which sounds like it is not there in any abundance like it was back then.
They wipe it out, cattle and sheep, but primarily the sheep. There were an unbelievable number of sheep grazed across eastern Oregon. A lot of them... itinerant shepherds that had their own little band but owned no land, and so they'd go wherever they could find grass, and several thousand of them, for instance, just on the slope of Steens Mountain, and the Taylor Grazing Act and the Bureau of Land Management come into being in large part because of the damage that this had done. The cattlemen themselves fight with the sheepmen over control of the range.
And it got ugly, didn't it?
Yes, there were murders. There were sheep killings of thousands of sheep by night riders. Ugly to an extreme degree. That would be about the turn of the century, beginning of the 20th century.
And of course, you know, in addition to all the ranching, we had crops there. I mean, in the northern part of eastern Oregon, we had the growing of wheat. And it's interesting to think about Pendleton in terms of it making money off of both industries, sheep and wheat as well.
Well, there's a map in the book that shows the sheep, shows the wheat lands. And when you look at the map, you notice it's not one continuous area. There are in between areas that aren't fit for wheat. And so the two could be side by side, but not on the same piece of land. They were complementary rather than competing.
All right, but Pendleton, I didn't realize, I never stopped to think before about the Pendleton woolen mills being created because of the fact that there was all that easy wool nearby from all the sheep.
Yes, yes. Pendleton and Heppner were both sheep towns as much as anything else. And then, of course, Shanico, which is now a ghost town out in the middle of nowhere, Shanico shipped several million tons of wheat, of wool in a single year in the early 20th century after the railroad reached there.
That is an amazing amount of wool. We'll talk more with Thomas R. Cox. His book is The Other Oregon, People, Environment, and History, East of the Cascades. You're welcome to join us by phone and email. We're back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. I thank you for listening and invite you to join our conversation with Thomas R. Cox, a historian who grew up in Eastern Oregon, spent much of his academic career at San Diego State University, now lives in McCammon, Idaho, in a place that looks very much like the Central Oregon that he remembers from his youth. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We've talked about cattle, sheep, and wheat up to a point. Let's talk about timber. Who was David Eccles, and how big a figure was he in establishing the timber industry in Eastern Oregon?
Eccles was a Mormon from originally Scotland, but from Ogden, Utah, who made his way by starting small sawmills in Utah and expanding, providing ties to the railroads and other construction timbers to the railroads that were expanding through the area, and decides to expand into Oregon, and he built the Oregon Lumber Company in Baker City, or Baker as we called it when I grew up.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the first big sawmill in Eastern Oregon. The reason was transportation. There aren't rivers that you can float the stuff to market like you can in so much of the Great Lakes timber country. But when the railroad comes through Baker, he puts two and two together, and by hook and by crook, and often by crook, got the title to all sorts of timberlands in the eastern Blue Mountains. And the big sawmills in Bend are the same sort of story. Bend becomes a major timber lumber producer, Brooks Scanlon, Shevlin Hixon, especially, after the railroad arrives. Transportation was the key.
Always had to have a place to get your stuff to market, and as
yep.
soon as the basically the conveyor belt of the market showed up, it encouraged people to get in there, which brings in this lingering question of why so many people moved to Eastern Oregon despite a relative lack of resources. And it was the railroads, as you point out, but the newspapers too. Talk about the role they played in the late 19th century.
Oh, boosterism was alive and well at that point in time. partly the railroads were self-interested. They'd built these expensive projects, and they needed people on the land to provide the traffic to make their investment pay. So they had magazines and puff pieces galore to urge people to settle on this wonderful land that's going to bloom like the rose. And, of course, a lot of what they were trying to puff was desert land that would never be productive to any great degree. So you have a huge influx of homestead seekers onto the high desert east of Bend and over further around Silver Lake and so on. And most of them get dusted out and starved out. So you see a lot of falling down remnants, but not many living ones.
Well, and you point out there was a dry farming congress to offer expertise to people trying to work the land, but it sounds like the vast majority of farmers went broke. You do point out that the travails of the farmers produced a fair body of literature. Tell us about that.
Yes. H.L. Davis's Honey and the Horn won the Pulitzer Prize in 1932, I believe. And it's an account of homesteaders moving across the Cascades, again from Josephine County, in search of this dream. And he's very sympathetic to them, and yet he recognizes that most of them were restless questers who are never going to be successful or happy wherever they went. And on the other hand, Anne Shannon Monroe writes a novel called Happy Valley, which hasn't had quite the critical applause that Davis's did. But Happy Valley is telling of these people too, but from a much more sympathetic viewpoint. She looks at the ones who really weren't just restless ne'er-do-wells, and treats them quite, as I say, quite sympathetically. Then there have been some poems and others, but those are the two main literary pieces that mark the area, aside from William Kittredge, much more recently. Mm-hmm. William Kittredge's memoir and various other books. Kittredge grew up near Adel, east of Lakeview, and writes movingly, marvelously about his experiences and his father and his grandfather. But it's interesting. His main memoir, Hole in the Sky, when the Library of Congress people were doing the cataloging information for it that would become the official blurb in all of the catalogs around the country, they said that the book deals with Montana.
Sorry, that was too good. Oh, man. And, of course, it's Eastern Oregon, which is what we're talking about here.
Yes, of course. And that's what Kittredge was talking about, too. Uh-huh. But Kittredge makes the point that, well, it's not really front and center in most people's minds.
No, it is not, which is hence the reason for your book. We did get a call here. You didn't stay on the line, but 10 in Humboldt County wanted to ask about some of the sheep herders, because his understanding is that some of them were Basque, and as you point out in the book, yes, indeed.
Yes. The Basques were a major part of those itinerant sheep herders that took their herds wherever and did a lot of the damage. But on the other hand, there were some that were settled down and quite successful, especially in the Jordan Valley and Rome areas. Some of them are still there, including a Basque peloton, the Hylai court in Jordan Valley in Jordan Valley that they built. The Irish were also extremely involved, especially in the Lakeview area. Lakeview became almost more Irish than anything else. I can remember still when I was in high school, when the Lakeview basketball team would come to town to play, practically everybody on the team was a Barry or an O'Leary or a O'Keefe.
I noticed that when I moved to Oregon in 1985, it seemed like half the county commissioners were O'Learys.
And one of the people who was big in bringing Irish to Lake County advised his friends in this area of Ireland, where most of them came from. He said, "Don't stop on the East Coast. Go directly to Jackie Flynn's sheep camp." Well, that's just east of Lakeview, away. Mm-hmm. And then Jackie Flynn would give them jobs and so on. And then when they'd made it a little bit, they would provide the money to bring over yet more relatives. And it became an ongoing thing.
Which we call chain migration today, I guess.
Yes, yes.
Right. So let's talk about the places that have really thrived despite the relative hardship of life in Eastern Oregon, like Bend. I mean, you talked about the history with the sawmills and that some wealthy people settled there. You got all the nice homes around the Mirror Pond. But what figures in its growth recently? How did Bend get so big in a time of timber decline?
Scenery. It's a lovely location. The Three Sisters and Broken Top and Mount Bachelor just off to the west, Mirror Pond through the middle of town. People looking for their version of the good life, and people who like skiing and fishing, world-class fishing on the Deschutes and some of the other Montolius and some of the other nearby streams, mountain lakes. So they've really, it's become an escape and has changed the place because people bring with them their culture. Mm-hmm. And that includes upscale boutiques, wine bars, things like that are as foreign to the old Bend as day is from night. And it causes tremendous angst among the old-timers. Hal Rothman, who is a historian at UNLV, some years ago wrote a book called Devil's Bargains. And he takes half a dozen different communities across the American West. Well, not just the West. He includes Lahaina in Hawaii. And talks about, these people want to bring in this stuff to replace the old economy that's crumbling or dying or is inadequate in one way or another. And they bring the people in, but then they have to live with what they've brought. And it's, as he says, a devil's bargain. It makes it uncomfortable in many ways.
Let's talk about the reference you made earlier, because it does get some space in the back of the book, the takeover at the Malheur Refuge a few years ago. And you said that there's something about Eastern Oregon that a lot of people don't understand that came into play there. I mean, is this and more than Eastern Oregon, this is just an Intermountain West kind of thing,
yes,
isn't it? The
is.
Attitude toward the land and its use?
Yes and no. The Bundys who come to Burns to save these ranchers who'd been so mistreated by the feds came with an outlook that it was the people versus the federal government, and that the land ought to go back to the people who were the rightful owners of all land. That wasn't really what was going on in Burns. This was a squabble between a couple of pretty feisty ranchers and the Fish and Wildlife Service over grazing rights and their use of the grazing land. And people in the Burns area didn't really see the feds as the enemy. They saw self-righteous technocrats in the Bureau of Land Management and in the Fish and Wildlife Service who thought they knew better than the people who lived on the land. So it's technocracy or technocratic hubris versus people who live on the land and know it probably better than some guy that just graduated from Oregon State and thinks he has all the answers.
So we have about a minute left here, and I just want to ask about some points on a starter tour of Eastern Oregon for people who want to get some of the feel. Skip Bend, it sounds like. Where would you recommend somebody start?
one area that is tremendously gorgeous is the Joseph Valley at the foot of the Wallowas. And the little towns of Joseph and Wallowa are really lovely places. And if you're up to some hiking, there's no better mountain experience than the Wallowa Mountains. The area in the Blue Mountains, west from Le Grand, you have to get off the paved roads for the most part, because they just don't go there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's about as empty a forested area as you could find. And the Blues are, they're not those spectacular mountains. They're high and sort of flat and with these big canyons. But it's a world that's quite different from the rest of Eastern Oregon. And then, of course, there are places like Prineville and Pendleton have wonderful historic museums.
Okay. Well, a good starter set there. Thanks for that. Thomas R. Cox, our guest on The Exchange, a historian who grew up in Eastern Oregon. His book is The Other Oregon, People, Environment, and History East of the Cascades. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Been mine too. That'll do it. That'll do it for today's Exchange. We're online at jeffexchange.org. We'll take a bit of a hiatus here on the program. Our producers are John Baxter and Angela Decker. Our student assistant Randy Babbitt is at the controls today. However you celebrate the holiday, enjoy it. We'll talk to you again soon on the Jefferson Exchange.